The government shutdown drags on, entering its third week with no end in sight. Is a bipartisan solution a possibility? Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is here to tell me. A Christian pastor in an underground church in China has been detained by Chinese communist authorities as they ordain a new Catholic bishop. Nina Shea of the Hudson Institute is here with analysis. And the assault on the traditional Latin Mass is expanding among U.S. dioceses as the young flock to the rite. What's driving it? Liturgy expert and president of Una Voce International, Joseph Shaw, reacts. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. I recently spoke with Speaker of the House Mike Johnson on my Arroyo Grande Show. I'll air the full interview next week, but I thought in the meantime you'd like to see a preview of what he told me about this lingering government shutdown and more. Watch. Mr. Speaker, thank you for the time. Thanks for coming in. This could well be the longest shutdown in history. How long do you think we're looking at here? What will break the dam here?
I wish I could tell you that. I hope it breaks soon. That's our prayer, because this is exacting real pain on real people. And every morning in the press conference, we come out and explain and go through the litany of pains that are being felt by real people. The Democrats in the Senate are playing politics right now for their own political fortunes. And only they can answer when the end will come. I hope it's soon.
Well, they claim these COVID-era Obamacare subsidies need to be replenished. Now, they couldn't pass this, because I remember this vote. They couldn't pass it when they had the opportunity and they had the House and Senate. But they're saying you have to do it or this is not going to end. Is that what it takes? Will that open the dam here?
No, because they filed a counterproposal that's filled with all sorts of things. That's just one of the demands. It's $1.5 trillion in new spending, including restoring taxpayer-funded health care to illegal aliens and non-citizens to the tune of about $200 billion. That's just one of the outrageous things they included in their demands.
Now they claim, do you see that in the bill? Do you believe that currently illegals have access to healthcare?
No, they don't, because we proscribed it in the law. In July 4th, in the One Big Beautiful Bill, We eliminated all the loopholes. They literally put in their counterproposal CR, go look at page 57, section 2141, and It says right there they want to repeal the health subsection of the One Big Beautiful Bill. Mm-hmm. Well, look into what that means.
That would invalidate.
It invalidates all the reforms. It restores the fraud, waste, and abuse back to Medicaid. It makes the system implode upon itself. Wow. And they're demanding that we claw back $50 billion that we put into the law to support rural hospitals. I mean, we're just not doing that. And they know it's absurd. They picked a fight because they had to show a fight against Trump. Here's what it boils down to, Raymond. Everybody knows the fact. Chuck Schumer is afraid of his shadow. There is a rising Marxist wing to the Democratic Party, and they're taking over the politics. They're about to elect Mondami, the mayor of New York City, as shocking as that is. And it shocks Chuck Schumer as well. He's assuming he will get a challenge from AOC or some other Marxist, and he doesn't want to do that. So he's got to show a fight right now, and his theory is that if he does that, if he digs in, then maybe they won't challenge him. The leaders of the Democrat Party right now are Bernie Sanders and AOC. That's the whole thing.
For the time being, the military isn't being paid, by the way. The president has found a way to pay them this pay period by basically taking from research and development money at the Pentagon.
Right.
How long can he keep that up?
Well, it's not a permanent situation. It's a Band-Aid fix, to your point. Right. I'm so grateful for a heroic commander-in-chief who understands the necessity of taking care of those who are taking care of all of us. But it is a temporary fix, because those are not inexhaustible funds. And the longer this goes, the more peril there is for people wearing the uniform.
What happens the next pay period? It's coming up.
It's a great question. We've got to solve this before the end of the month. And, you know, in order to process the paychecks on time, you have to have at least two business days for this to be resolved. So the clock is ticking. Everybody knows they're having a Hate America rally on Saturday. They call it the No Kings. We call it what it really is. And watch for the video. There'll be Antifa and BLM and, you know, Marxist and the pro-Hamas wing. They'll all be out there. They cannot resolve this before then because they're afraid to face that angry mob. And I hope after that, at least a handful of sensible Democrats will come to do the right thing.
How do you, as Speaker, balance what you... I mean, you're 219 is your majority to 213, and that number may be adjusting in a day or two.
Right.
How do you deal with that slender majority, Mr. Speaker?
For much of this Congress, 90 or so of the first 100 days, we had a literal one-vote margin. Mm-hmm. On any given day, we have one or two votes, which means everybody's got to come along. Now, I'm happy to tell you, Raymond, it's a lot of work and effort, a lot of prayer and patience, but we have the most unified Republican Party we've ever had. I mean, the White House, the Senate, and the House Republicans are aligned. There's a couple of outliers, one or two. But by and large, everyone's rowing in the same direction, and they're doing it enthusiastically. That's a big thing.
There is this Thomas Massie discharge position that now, you know, to release the Epstein files. Your thoughts on this? There's a new member you're about to swear in. They think that will tip the balance. He'll have the signatures, and that will force a vote on the floor.
It probably will. This is Rep. Grijalva of Arizona, and when she takes her oath, she's going to sign, I'm sure, and that'll be it. The discharge petition is a totally moot point now. Why do we say that? Because the House Oversight Committee is dug in deeply on this. Some of the biggest bulldogs in Congress, Republicans and Democrats, working together to comb through the Epstein files and release them publicly. So 34,000 documents have been released. More are on the way. Yeah. While the government is shut down, the House Oversight Committee's attorneys have been in New York spending a lot of time going through the Epstein estate files, not even anticipated in the discharge petition. We're for maximum transparency. It's all going to come out, but we have to make sure that we protect and redact the names of the innocent victims, and that's something we have a real responsibility to do.
The full interview with Speaker Johnson will air on the Arroyo Grande Show next Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on our YouTube channel. Go subscribe. A pastor of a huge underground house church in China is being detained by the Communist Chinese authorities, along with a dozen other Christian pastors. How long could these detentions go on, and what's being done internationally, particularly in the U.S., to gain these pastors' release? Here to discuss, director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, Nina Shea. Nina, always so good to see you. Now, last week, police in China detained a dozen of these pastors at one of the largest churches in home churches in what they're calling the biggest crackdown since 2018. Pastor Jin, they call him Ezra Jin, the founder of this Zion Church, is an unofficial house church not sanctioned by the government. He was detained at his home. Jin is being charged with illegal use of information networks. What does that mean? What is exactly he being charged with here?
He is being charged initially, this is just the first stage, with using the internet to preach. And he refuses to be part of the government's Patriotic Church Association, which is now part of the United Front Work Department of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. So he is a man of principle, and he's obviously his word resonates, his approach resonates. He has 40 churches in his network throughout China. And that is why he's being punished. I work with his son-in-law.
Yeah, your colleague.
My colleague at the Hudson Institute, Bill Drexel, is married to his daughter. Mm-hmm. And so I spoke to them about his fate and what's happening.
And what are they saying? What do they know about his detention?
That he has a lawyer. They haven't been able to communicate with him directly. I think his wife has. And they're all Americans, the wife and the children. He is not. He's Chinese. That is Pastor Ezra. They expect him to go to trial eventually. Now, that can take years in China, as we saw, with Jimmy Lai.
Yeah, we're going to talk about in a minute. Yeah.
So they think that this is the beginning of the charges. They fear that he'll be charged with something else.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke out about this detention of Zion Church leaders, including Pastor Jin. In an official statement, he said the following: "The United States condemns the Chinese Communist Party's recent detention of dozens of leaders of the unregistered House Zion Church in China, including prominent Pastor Ezra Jin." How important is the U.S. State Department's voice in this matter? Does it make a difference? Does China respond at all to this?
It does make a difference. It's very important to keep the pressure on, to keep his case alive, to keep his name in the public sphere. And think about it, Raymond. They're alienating, that is, the Chinese Communist Party, who arrested these pastors, are alienating, thousands, 10,000 or more Chinese people who see them as a spiritual guide, as their leader. And as a religious, beloved religious leader.
Secretary of the Treasury Scott Bessent said the president plans to meet with Xi, President Xi of China, in the coming weeks. He's doing a tour of Asia. Your thoughts on whether this predicament will be brought up of not only Pastor Jin, but so many of these pastors, even in the Catholic sphere.
The Catholic bishops who are detained.
Who've been house arrested or just disappeared.
Disappeared. Yes. Well, President Trump has raised these cases in the past, and he has a big concern about this. I urge him to raise these names again and not let it drop.
Yeah. There's been a concerted effort. We've seen this in the Catholic area, also among these home churches, a Sinization, a Chinesification, if you will, of religion. What are they doing vis-a-vis these house churches, Nina?
Well, they have put all sorts of rules and constraints on them and controlling the leadership of these churches and requiring them to ban all children from their churches, to base their homilies on Xi Jinping's thoughts and Communist Party doctrine, to conform to Communist doctrine. So it's they want to control, and that's why he's been arrested. They want to control every aspect of civic society, including the churches and religion.
Mm. According to Reuters, China has 44 million Chinese Christians registered in these state-sanctioned churches, Nina. The majority of Protestant, official figures show, but tens of millions are estimated to be part of the home churches, that house churches that operate outside the control of the Communist Party. Are they effectively trying to stamp out these underground home churches the way we've seen them stamp out and destroy the underground Catholic Church?
Yes, I think that they want to eliminate the house churches completely, bring everything under the control, consolidate control. It's about power. It's about domination of thought and of action and of leadership.
Tell me, how does that Vatican-China agreement that we've been reporting on literally for years, and at times the only outlet reporting this, and you one of the few voices raising concerns, how did that China Vatican deal that Pope Francis initiated, Cardinal Parolin, who's still the Vatican Secretary of State, was really instrumental in shaping. How has this impacted these home churches, Protestant home churches?
Yeah, well, they have not raised any concerns for the fate of these house churches at all. That is the Vatican. They don't talk about their own church, and defend that. This agreement that was signed in 2018 and has been extended throughout the years by the Vatican, I see it as a legal fiction.
Why?
It's basically a hoax. It's to pretend that the government pretends to give papal power or respect for papal power of an appointment of bishops and give them a say in it. And the Vatican, in turn, pretends that they have a say. But in fact, we've just seen this week with a new bishop appointed by the Communist Party, Bishop Ignatius Wu, he's called, recognized by the Vatican this week. Finally, they have.
And he was appointed, we should say, he was appointed during the interregnum between the death of Pope Francis and the election of Leo.
Right.
The Chinese suddenly announced this new bishop for Shanghai, right?
For Shanghai, the most important diocese to the Catholic Church in China. It was the largest, and this was Cardinal Kung's diocese.
Wow.
He spent three decades in prison for refusing to join the Patriotic Association, as this Pastor Wu has done. So this new bishop is taking the place of two bishops in Shanghai who are living right now, who are alive, appointed by the past popes, who are either in detention for 13 years somewhere in the seminary.
We don't know where they are?
Well, we know where one is. He's okay. Detained in the seminary for 13 years. He's isolated. He cannot come out. And the other one is disappeared. And he's been disappeared for 13 years, and we don't know where he is.
I have to tell you, Nina, it almost makes you weep, because no one at the Vatican is protesting the detention of actually consecrated bishops who have been sent there by the church, while these Confederates on October 15th, the Chinese just had this dumb show of a consecration mm-hmm. of a bishop that I guess the Vatican's just going to allow to happen. There's been no protest against him, and he is the installed bishop now of Shanghai.
It's a Vatican policy of appeasement, and the communists are putting their people into pivotal positions in all the churches, and systematically, relentlessly, and there's no protest, as you say, from the Vatican.
And what's the message that it sends to the people? Because I know there are faithful, still, underground Catholics who are having private masses and trying mm-hmm. to hold their devotional life together. What message does this send to them?
Well, I think it's going to drive away a lot of Catholics, Raymond, because I think they're going to think that they can go to party. They have to go to party indoctrination sessions in the neighborhood anyhow on a regular basis. Why do they have to go to the Catholic Church to hear a sermon from the bishop or the priest under him based on the Communist Party doctrine?
Wow. And no, it's outrageous.
I think it's going to drive people away.
Yeah.
The church is going to wither away. And that's exactly what the communists want. Yeah. I mean, it's basically, if in 2018, the Communist Party put all the churches, Catholic and Protestant, who are members of this patriotic associations, under the Communist Party's United Front Work Department. This is the main propaganda and surveillance operation of the Communist Party.
I mean, it would have been better, which we had under John Paul and Benedict. You privately consecrate and appoint bishops. You let them quietly go about feeding their flock, and you at least maintain the doctrinal integrity of the gospel of Jesus Christ that I thought the church was here to protect and propagate. But now it seems we're willing to trade that, Nina, and put Xi at the center of the gospel and allow heresy to be spread in the name of Catholicism.
Yeah, and we know the Catholic Church knows how to do underground.
We did it in all throughout the Eastern Bloc.
Eastern Bloc during the Cold War. The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church really pioneered this while they stayed alive. You know, they stayed
kept the flame.
Yeah. Now, the Vatican has never recognized these patriotic associations as legitimate Catholic institutions. No pope has recognized them, yet they're encouraging them to all join that, and then they're agreeing to the consecration of bishops coming out of there.
Well, there was a story of Chinese special police raiding a Catholic prayer service during Lent. Do you know anything about this? Worshippers were assaulted. There was a father of three, I guess, was in a coma, and priests were arrested.
Yeah, well, that kind of thing will happen from time to time because there is a consolidation of power in Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party. They don't want any activity or organization outside the party. Everything has to be within the party.
Yeah. No, I tell you this, you have to give the communists credit for this. They have a brilliant strategy. It's a global strategy. And they know, kill the faith, kill free media. And if you can kill those things and control it, you can do what you want. Mm-hmm. And this is what we're seeing. And that opens up, sadly, the story of Jimmy Lai, who is facing a foreign collusion trial that could end in a life sentence. What do you think is going to happen there? The trial is complete.
The trial is finished, and he is waiting sentencing now. And And also, I guess, a determination of his guilt. But I think it's almost a foregone conclusion that he's going to be found guilty because the court boasts of 100% conviction rate, that particular court. And I think that, the man is 77 years old. He's in poor health. He has diabetes. He's developed heart conditions while he's been in prison. Yeah. It could be any sentence could be a life sentence for him. And so he is another hero of our faith because he stood up for his principles. He refused to bow to false doctrines. And he refused to flee because he wanted, out of love for the other dissidents in Hong Kong, to give an example.
Yeah, even as a British citizen, which he
British is. British citizen,
yeah,
lots of money.
He decided to stay.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable. Yeah. I have to ask you about what's happening in Nigeria. I know radical Islamists have been just savaging Christians in this land. You sent a letter to President Trump signed by 30 prominent Christian voices, including Archbishop Corleone, Focus on the Family, others. You want President Trump to do what?
We want him to simply acknowledge that this is happening, that this massacres of Christians, persecution, burnings, rape, burnings of churches, rapes of women, killing, mass killings of villagers, of farming villages, by a non-state actor, by these Fulani herdsmen. These are Muslim militants. They carry AKs. They're not the typical herdsmen.
Right.
And they swarm a village and massacre or drive out everyone. And they're doing this relentlessly, systematically in the Middle Belt where the Christians are. And the government does not lift a finger to help them or to prosecute any of these Fulani.
Well,
so we want an acknowledgement, Raymond, from President Trump that there is severe persecution.
What will that achieve?
It will achieve moral opprobrium helps. They desperately don't want it. They're sending their lobbyists here. The legislators or a team are coming here, a delegation, actually abetting this crime against humanity. Nigeria is the deadliest place in the world for Christians because of their faith, according to Open Doors, a very respected research group.
Mm-hmm.
Christians are disproportionately targeted and attacked. I mean, they have a lot of terror groups there, Islamic terror groups, Boko Haram, Islamic State is there, other al-Qaeda-linked groups.
But they're all targeting the Christians.
They're targeting the Christians. They also target the Muslims. But these Fulani militants are not considered a terror group. They have not been designated as such by the United States. And so they're invisible. I mean, this issue, there's been, radio silence on this issue. The State Department up until now, under the Biden administration, has blamed it on climate change.
Oh, I remember that.
And that these are two socioeconomic groups. These are Fulani herdsmen and farmers.
You're
and
right.
Farmers and herders are clashing. They don't recognize that these are the targeting of a particular religious
it's
group.
It's religiously motivated violence.
Yeah,
they
wouldn't
acknowledge
the Fulanis come in on their motorcycles, maybe hundreds at a time, with the AKs, screaming the war cry, Allahu Akbar, as they slaughter. And, we had a bishop come here from Benue State. Mm-hmm. Bishop Inagbe came to Washington, testified before Christmas Subcommittee on Africa in the House. And he gave this, just searing testimony about the massacres in his diocese. And when he went back, his home village was attacked and 12 of his relatives were massacred. Weeks later, his office sent me their names. These 12, the numbers are elastic, but I got the names of his relatives. And the head of his Justice and Peace Department had to flee the country.
Wow. This is,
because
they're
targeted.
The crime of this, and we've been reporting on it, but it gets no coverage anywhere else. You'll never see this on the nightly news. You don't see it. Bill Maher, to his great credit, mentioned it a few weeks ago.
Yes. And he's not a Christian.
He's an atheist. Bill is a former Catholic. He's outraged by this, as he should, as anybody who is half a brain should be. In your letter, you say, according to the Catholic Conference in Nigeria, at least 145 priests have been kidnapped, 11 murdered. Four remain missing since 2015, and three churches are devastated every day in Nigeria. Nearly, get the number, 15 million people displaced. Nina, you say the Nigerian government is directly violating religious freedom by enforcing this Islamic blasphemy law. We've talked about this before. Give me a sense of the enforcement, what it looks like. Why are they doing this?
There's Sharia law in 12 of the states there, and they're imposing these blasphemy laws against Christians as well as Muslims, and it carries the death penalty. It's one of the worst, more draconian in the world, actually. Not many Muslim countries do that. That is have a death penalty attached to it. But they're also indirectly violating religious freedom. By tolerating it, by tolerating the targeting of these Christians for violence and mayhem, allowing that to go on unimpeded, with total impunity. No Fulani has ever been arrested and prosecuted and convicted for this.
Wow.
And there have been constant pleas coming out of these Christian areas for help from the government, and the president of Nigeria does nothing.
Okay. Just to circle the ribbon on this, there are lobbyists, as you mentioned a moment ago, coming from the Nigerian parliament to lobby our senators and congresspeople against designating Nigeria as a country of concern.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they so adamant about that? And what influence could a Trump administration pushback have on this situation?
Senator Ted Cruz has introduced a bill calling for CPC in the Senate, that is country of particular concern, designating it as a serious, you know, egregious violator of religious freedom. Congressman Chris Smith, who's the chair of the Subcommittee on Africa in the House, he has done likewise. He also has a bill pending calling for this designation.
Mm-hmm.
President Trump should immediately designate them as a country of particular concern. There are no mandatory sanctions. People are very worried about the oil, the rare earth minerals in Nigeria. There's no mandatory sanctions under this designation. They could have other policy approaches to calling the president of Nigeria to take action to protect all its citizens, including the Christians of the Middle Belt.
Nina Shea, as always, thank you for coming here,
thank
for being
you,
so
Raymond.
Clear. Look, I know this is a difficult conversation, but this is really why Mother Angelica founded the place, if you want to know. It's to give voice to the voiceless, and God knows these poor people in Nigeria, the Christians suffering in China, they are those voiceless people. Keep them in your prayers. Nina Shea's reporting on the persecution of Christians worldwide can be found at Hudson.org. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you, Raymond. God bless you for focusing on it.
Thank you. Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with Grammy-winning country pop legend Crystal Gayle this week for an intimate conversation about faith, family, and finding her own voice beyond her sister Loretta Lynn's towering shadow. Did you know she was Loretta Lynn's sister? Take a look. One of the things I love about country music is, like jazz, it came up from the local people and the sharing of those sounds and beats and rhythms and nationalities. It kind of all blended, and you learned from neighbors and from friends and from parents. What did you pick up from your immediate family that you see in your work even today?
Well, I think a lot of love. You were there, and everybody would sing, and just that family life. And I always thought everybody had a wonderful family like I did. Uh-huh. And then you finally, you grow up, and you realize, well, not really. I was very lucky to have really good parents and brothers and sisters. And Loretta would never let me forget I was the baby. I mean, if she was here right now, I'm still the baby.
The baby. Yeah. Well, you did emulate her at the beginning. I mean, how could you not? I mean, she's taking off. You're still a young kid.
And let me go back a little bit with my sister, Loretta. She told me to quit singing her songs. She said, don't sing or record anything that I would. She said, you will only be compared. And I really think that's why I had the success. Because people didn't, I'd find people that didn't know we were related. Or some would say, you can't be her sister. You don't sound like her. But they didn't realize, you know, there's about 19 years in between.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with legendary singer Crystal Gayle is on YouTube, or on the Arroyo Grande Show, wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Go subscribe. Don't miss the show. It's free, of course. And be on the lookout for this Friday's episode of The Prayerful Posse. Ooh, it's a hot one. More U.S. bishops are announcing bans on the traditional Latin Mass in an attempt to comply with the late Pope Francis's document, Traditiones Custodes. Why is there an escalation in this liturgical crackdown now? And what is Pope Leo's position on all of this? Here with analysis of this ever-expanding assault, I'm joined by liturgy expert, president of Una Voce International, Joseph Shaw. Joseph, thanks for being here. This week, a brand new Latin Mass ban was announced for the Diocese of Knoxville in Tennessee, which includes Knoxville and Chattanooga. Pastors there announced that they, along with their bishop, Mark Beckman, will begin to transition to the ordinary form of the Mass in late December. Joseph, the drive to implement Pope Francis's directive continues. 11 U.S. dioceses so far have embraced this. What do you think is driving this new push? You would have thought with a new pope, we might have seen a cessation of this.
Yes, indeed. And I must say, I find it very puzzling, very strange indeed. I assume this is something to do with the attitude of the bishops concerned. It may also be connected with the papal nuncio in America. Is it coming from Pope Leo? Well, if it were, then I think we'd see more of it around the world. This is something which seems to be unique to America. I haven't heard about this coming from Italy or France or England, where I am. Hmm. In fact, the bishops in England seem to be more relaxed now than they were 6 months ago about the traditional Mass. So this is a real puzzle.
Yeah, it's troubling. And again, you have people in the United States who actually moved cross country to be closer to these traditional Latin Mass communities because they wanted to have access to the Mass every week. And now the Masses have vanished in their communities. There is this idea, and we heard this from the Pope Leo in a recent long form interview he did with Elise Allen, that if you celebrate the new Mass in Latin and keep the incense and some of the trappings, that will be enough to satisfy the Latin Mass goers. Is it, Joseph?
No, it's not. It's interesting that he made that remark. I mean, he posed it as a rhetorical question. Wouldn't that be the same experience? I would be surprised if he really thought that was the same experience, but maybe he does. But we have to disabuse him of that if we would do if we were asked. And of course, the whole history of the traditional Latin Mass movement is that it's not enough. But another aspect of that history, of course, is that is not something we've been offered consistently, whether we want it or not. There are some people who like that. And they have had a pretty difficult time in America and Britain and elsewhere. It's promoting the Novus Ordo in Latin has often been regarded as tantamount to schismatic tendencies and all the other things that we're accused of. So it's hard to know whether, you know, Pope Leo was maybe thinking aloud, these letters, I mean, is this a genuine offer even? Because some of the bishops who've restricted Latin Mass, the traditional Latin Mass, have also restricted more conservative ways of celebrating the Novus Ordo.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, when you compare the two rites, as I recently did, and I've read some articles about this, the prefaces of the traditional Latin Mass, only 13% of those prefaces carried over into the new Mass. 13%. So it is a very different rite, though they're both the Roman rite. They're very different in substance, not only in style and presentation. Joseph, implicit in these letters announcing the closures in Chattanooga, especially the accusations of broken unity, keep emerging, even suggesting in one of the letters that clinging to the ancient Latin rite is somehow Protestantism. Your take on this?
Yes. I mean, that is a really extraordinary remark because, you know, Protestants are not characterized by their clinging to liturgical forms, with perhaps the exception of a few Anglicans who are very attached to the Book of Common Prayer. It's not a characteristic of Protestantism at all. I'm afraid that's an example of people who think that any heresy is should be called by the name of their most familiar heresy, in this case, Protestantism. There are different kinds of ways of erring, but this is certainly not Protestant attitude. So our attachment to tradition is an attachment to the church. Our attachment to the church is an attachment to Christ. Christ speaks to us through the church's traditions. That isn't something which any Catholic theologian who's remotely Orthodox could deny. That's where we get our doctrine from. It's how we are taught to pray in the liturgy through the traditions of the church. Now, that doesn't mean the Pope doesn't have authority over the liturgy. He certainly does, and we accept that.
Yeah.
But the idea that there's a tension between attachment to the church, attachment to the unity of the church, and attachment to the church's traditions, especially ones as venerable as this, and that's a non-starter.
Yeah, well, Joseph, one of the perplexing things, I guess, in all of this, in one of these letters, there was a suggestion that if you want this old mass, somehow you are breaking unity with the Pope. And it's this idea that Pope's personal perspective or their personal like can't be wrong. But Pope Benedict was apparently wrong because Pope Francis said he was. And I mean, is this only whatever the latest Pope says is what goes? There's a very odd economy that we've seemed to be setting up here, which relies on whoever the latest man elected is. And that really isn't the nature of the Catholic Church. Catholic Church is the repository of the doctrine of faith, not the whims of whoever's elected tomorrow.
Yes, it's absolutely right. I mean, it's like a parody of the Catholic Church. It's like what C.S. Lewis said. He didn't like the idea of becoming a Catholic himself because it was like agreeing with someone before you knew what they were going to say. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, that's obviously absurd. We accept the faith in its entirety because we do know what it is. It's been communicated to us through the magisterium, and it's the deposit of faith, and that doesn't change. So in this case, even things that can change, we have to respect tradition, because tradition is not just a kind of neutral mechanism by which, you know, things get out of date. It's actually a way for God to communicate to us his will.
There's been no direct word yet, or ruling, if you will, from Pope Leo on this matter. But I think it bears noting that Cardinal Roche, who is the head of the Vatican Liturgy Office, his mandate was just renewed by Pope Leo. And he seems to be, at least in the Chattanooga case, they mentioned that it was Roche's office that reached out to lean on the bishop and say, hey, are you implementing custodis, traditionis custodis? Meaning, when are you going to curtail that old rite? So there seems to be an embrace of what's happening now from the current pope. What do you think's happening here?
It's difficult to tell. I mean, the other direct indication of his attitude is his allowing Cardinal Raymond Burke to celebrate the traditional mass in St. Peter's.
Yes.
Just in 10 days' time from now. So I will be there in St. Peter's, and Cardinal Burke will be celebrating that mass. And if that isn't indication that the Pope Leo is okay with this mass, I really don't know what would be. But that's something which stopped under Pope Francis. We didn't have that mass. It's an annual event for 2 years.
Right.
So, you know, this is actually a positive step forward for the organizers of the pilgrimage.
Yeah.
It's not a just something carrying on. Mm. He's spoken to Pope, to Cardinal Burke. He's spoken to Cardinal Sarah. What's going on here? Well, Cardinal Roche is entitled to implement what he regards as the policy. But if you actually look at the document that he's implementing, Traditionis Custodes, it's quite clear that all these bishops in America, if they wanted to make provision for the traditional mass, they are actually invited to do so. The problem only arises with the use of parish churches. So if they were to designate a church as a shrine, then, or if there's a church belonging to a religious order somewhere which isn't a parish church, then they could do that. And as I say, it's actually invited to do it in the very first articles of the document. So this seems to go beyond normal reading of Traditionis Custodes.
Yeah, well, Pope Leo, I know weeks ago said that during this pilgrimage of those who love the traditional Latin rite, which you mentioned a moment ago, Cardinal Raymond Burke's going to celebrate the traditional mass there at St. Peter's, that Pope Leo said he would take that as an opportunity to dialogue and meet with the folks who were there. So I hope that happens, and we'll see. But it seems to me, Joseph, and maybe it's just my own sense of justice, but if the Vatican Library can allow a Muslim prayer room, I think Catholics who love the old rite should be entitled to celebrate that rite in their parish, not at some, you know, at a firehouse or at some, outhouse, but actually in their parish. I don't understand what the great sin is there. And I think Traditionis Custodis needs a good looking at. It just seems like an unjust document.
Yes, yes. Those of us who have been associated with the traditional movement for a long time, of course, we're used to being given the crumbs off the table, and we're grateful for them. My first prolonged experience, a regular experience of the traditional mass, was in a secular meeting room, which was hired by the hour, not because we were some sort of peculiar Saint of Acanthus group. We had permission of the Archbishop, because he gave us permission to have the mass, but he didn't provide a church to have it in. it's very sad. It makes you feel unwelcome. It makes you feel that the bishop does not really care about your pastoral needs. You're not really part of the family. You're the kind of orphaned kid that's being kind of allowed, maybe occasionally, to come in, is not given a seat at the table. It's really sad, and it has a very bad psychological effect on the faithful, this. Yeah. And that really, people who complain about radicalization and ingratitude and feeling, you know, traditionalists, you know, being overcritical, well, they should look in the mirror and ask, well, how could that possibly be? No, why do people become like that? Marginal people become radicalized. I'm sorry, if you don't like it, you should stop marginalizing them.
Well, and we saw the cessation of all of this during Benedict's reign, because he gave free rein to the old rite with the new one and said, here, let them all, let all the flowers grow. That is the answer. It worked. I mean, we saw it working. I want to quote something. This is Pope Benedict. Pope Benedict said back in 1997, I am of the opinion, to be sure, that the old rite should be granted much more generously to all those who desire it. It's impossible to see what could be dangerous or unacceptable about that. A community is calling its very being into question when it suddenly declares that what until now was its holiest and highest possession is strictly forbidden, and when it makes the longing for it seem downright indecent. That was Cardinal Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict, in Salt of the Earth. The Church has always taught the Eucharist confected in either liturgy of the Roman Rite is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ. What could be wrong there, Joseph?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I share your puzzlement. On what Pope Benedict said, I think it's important that it's not just bad for these peculiar, eccentric Catholics who attach to the traditional mass. It's actually bad for everyone, because it gives the impression that there's something bad about the church's past. There's something wrong with how Catholics celebrated Mass for century after century, that whole liturgy, that whole spirituality, that whole outlook on life is something that has to be rejected and cast off. You can't live like that as a Catholic.
No.
Now, people sometimes say, oh, we have this great advantage over Protestantism because you look at history and stuff. Well, I'm sorry, if you look at history and say it was all terrible, it was all darkness until the Second Vatican Council, then, well, you're not doing a very good job as a Catholic historian.
Well,
you're just playing into Protestants' hands.
Yeah, yeah. This is corporate amnesia, because what you're basically saying is everything that came before me was useless or rigid, yeah. and you know, these people were deluding themselves. This is where we're the only people that are happening and have it. Cardinal Robert Sarra spoke out on these liturgy wars in a new French language interview on YouTube. Here's what he had to say. We have turned the Mass into a battlefield, traditionalist, progressive, this and that, and we are profaning the Eucharist. Why forbid this or that? Who gives us the right to prevent someone from being personally united with God? In fact, those who truly practice their faith today are often the ones who attend the traditional Mass. Why forbid them? On the contrary, they should be encouraged. Joseph, what are you seeing? I see a lot of young people flooding to the old rite. I call it the old rite. Some people get upset when I say that. The traditional mass, the ancient Roman rite. What might happen if this ban, this idea that this is a filthy rite that we can no longer embrace, if that continues, what happens to those young people who are coming to that rite and drawn to it?
Yeah, well, it's very discouraging for them. it's very discouraging. I think, I mean, the feeling that of, you know, being rejected, of not being listened to, you know, that this is a church which is not for you. I remember when I was a student, I lived in a place where there were a lot of Benedictines, young monks, and many of them were very conservative in the 90s. And they went back to their monasteries after doing a degree in Oxford. And nearly all of them ended up leaving their communities. Those communities couldn't cope with conservative young monks. And we're in danger of doing the same thing. We have this generation of young people who are more conservative than me. I feel quite, I've been overtaken by these, the young people. Whatever, their attitudes are different. The circumstances are different. What they're reading is different.
Yeah.
That's how life is. It doesn't stand still. So we've got to find a way of bringing them into the church, which works for them. And works for the church. From a purely selfish point of view, I don't want to be the last Catholic. I don't want to be the last one to close down my local churches and go to my grave without anyone to mourn me because there aren't any more Catholics.
Well,
we've got to make this work.
It's fascinating to me, Joseph, watching the embrace of climate change people and LGBT people and Muslims praying at the Vatican Library. So there's an impulse to go out to bring people closer to you. But the people who are actual members of your family and the most vibrant young shoots in your garden, we just want to, pour kerosene on and light them a fire and drive them out. It makes no sense. But here's the data. I'm going to end here. Interesting, among young clergy, the national study of Catholic priests conducted by Gallup finds that younger priests identify as significantly more conservative in outlook than their older brethren. About 51% of priests ordained since 2010 said their political views are either conservative or very conservative. And here's the kicker. 39% of young American priests consider access to the traditional Latin Mass a priority. Your thoughts on these findings, Joseph?
Yeah. This is true all over the world. It's not just an American phenomenon, and it's very heartening. It's partly simply a kind of pendulum thing. I looked at that survey, and it was interesting to see what the alternatives were, and it was things like climate change and immigration and things. Well, those may be important issues, but they are not what Christ founded the church to preach to the world. What Christ wants those priests to do is to save souls. And I think this younger generation of priests is thinking, well, in order to have a priestly identity, in order to have a Christian community that makes sense, we've got to focus on the core issues. And one of the ways to do that is things like the traditional Mass or Eucharistic adoration. That was another issue.
Mm-hmm.
And well, good for them, because they could see this other stuff isn't working.
No.
And Greta Thunberg is doing all that. Well, fine, let her get on with it. But we've got other things that we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, well, Greta does this much better than most priests. Just let her do that.
Yes.
If they confect the sacraments and, hold us together in the parish, that'll be enough. Follow the work of Joseph Shaw and Una Voce International at unavoce.org. Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you.
He's a successful award-winning actor, producer, New York Times bestselling author whose unique career bridges the worlds of entertainment, spirituality, and personal development. He's also starring in a new film, Soul on Fire, based on the life and experience of John O'Leary, who suffered horrific burns in a terrible fire. Through his battle to survive, O'Leary discovers what it means to truly live. Here to tell us about it all is our pal, Devon Franklin. Devon, thanks for being here. And as we were talking about before we came on, you also have that fantastic Ruth and Boaz on Netflix that you produced, which I want people to take a peek at. But Soul on Fire is what we're talking about now. John O'Leary, the subject of the movie, he was burned over 100% of his body in this fire, an accident at his parents' St. Louis home about 40 years ago. How did you come to be a part of this movie?
Raymond, it's good to see you as always. Thanks for having me back.
Sure.
You know, I became a part of this film. I know Sean McNamara, who's the director.
Yep.
And one day he texted me and said, hey, I'd love for you to be in this movie. And along with sending me a script, he sent me a personalized video from the real John O'Leary. And in that video, John O'Leary was expressing to me, you know, why he wanted me to play Nurse Roy, why he thought I would be good for that part. And Nurse Roy is the real nurse that helped rehabilitate John when he was 9 years old after he had gotten burned. And when I read the script and I watched the video from John O'Leary, I just knew that I had to be a part of this film. It's such an uplifting story. It's such a family film. And I was really, really just honored that they would think of me and consider me to help bring John's story to life.
Devon, I want to give folks a taste of Soul on Fire. Here's a little clip. This is John's mom speaking to him before he's wheeled into surgery, right after he's burned. Watch.
You're going to have to fight like you've never fought before, and take God's hand and walk with him. And Daddy and I are going to be with you every step of the way.
Devon, as you mentioned, you play Nurse Roy in the movie. How did you prepare for the role? You met with the real Nurse Roy, I assume.
Well, actually, the real Nurse Roy is, I mean, he's truly a servant in that he doesn't want any publicity. It's like he did what he did for John just because that's what he did. So, you know, even, you know, I attempted to reach out to him, but he just said, you know, I don't want to, you know, he doesn't want the spotlight. So what I did was I did a lot of research with other nurses in burn units and really talked to them and to get a better idea of what goes into caring for a burn patient. I read books, you know, about burn units and burn patients to really understand. And one of the things that I discovered through that research is that when you have the type of burns that John O'Leary had when he was 9 years old, that any sort of movement is extremely painful. And that was really important to know so that as I, you know, played the part, I could really, dealing with young John, deal with him with a lot of care and still understand that I had to put him through some pain in order for him to not experience the pain of never walking again. Mm. So preparing for the role was great, and I really had the opportunity to better understand what goes into, you know, caring for patients like this.
Devon, family really is at the center of this movie. John's appreciation for his brother, his four sisters, who ultimately saved his life. There's a unique bond with his dad. How was John's family key to his recovery?
You know, John's family was key to his recovery in the way that so many of our families are key to our recovery when we go through things. They surrounded him. They loved him. They cared for him. They were compassionate with him. And dare I say, they were even tough with him. There's a scene in the movie when John comes home from the hospital and he is, you know, on the road to recovery and he sits down to eat. And if you've seen the film or you've seen the trailer, like, you know, he isn't able to use his hands because the burn has really affected his ability to use his hands. And his sister goes to help him eat and the mother says no. And she stops the sister from helping him, and the mother makes him learn to eat by himself. In that particular meal, it took him hours to learn. And some may say, oh, well, that was really tough. But what did it do? It helped to prepare him for life. So today, John can, you know, use his hands to eat, to drive, to get dressed, and do all the things that anyone else can do. And that would have never happened if it wasn't for his family that gave him love, but also tough love.
Yeah, and faith is also a key component here in the movie. The O'Leary family is seen praying grace before meals. His mom and dad pray at the hospital chapel later in the film. John and Beth's wedding was shot at the Shrine of St. Joseph in downtown St. Louis. John's wife, Beth O'Leary, was a former occupational therapist. She's also an essential part of this story. How was her support central to John?
She used to be a contractor.
It was, I mean, I think, you know, John would say that, you know, without her support, he wouldn't be where he is and being able to do the things that he's able to do. You know, when you look at how she loved him, you know, there's a beautiful scene in the movie, you know, that when they get married and John O'Leary, you know, takes off his shirt and he wants to turn off the light because of his scars. And she says, no, you know, your scars are you and I love you and I love your scars. And she kisses the scars. And so I think, you know, her support is just everything. And I think when you see their love on screen, it's just reminded that love is, it reminds us that love is one of the most powerful forces, if not the most powerful force in the universe.
Yeah.
And when we give that to one another, that's when the miracles happen.
Yeah, and it really is a story of redemption through pain, through suffering. I mean, that's really at the heart of Soul of Fire. What do you want audiences to take away from the film and your performance in it? You will
walk again. Yeah, you know, I want audiences, first of all, I want, you know, audiences to go to theaters to see this movie. This movie, Soul on Fire, will be in theaters nationwide October 10th. And I want audiences to take their entire family. This is the type of movie you can watch with the youngest all the way to the oldest. You don't have to cover eyes. You don't have to cover ears. Everybody wants Hollywood to make more uplifting films. Well, here it is. Soul on Fire is that film. It is one of the most uplifting films of the year. So I would encourage any family to go see it. You are going to enjoy it. And I would love for people to get from my performance of Nurse Roy the power of compassion. Doing for others what they may not be able to do for themselves, and being of service. Those are the two things that I would love people to take from my performance, because of what Nurse Roy did for young John O'Leary. John O'Leary then had a fighting chance to become the man that he's become. And so often, unsung heroes in our life, the angels in our life, don't always get their just due. But my hope is anyone seeing this film would look at the angel of Nurse Roy and the role he played, and make the decision to become more compassionate and to become, more loving.
Devon, we will leave it there. Soul on Fire, directed by Sean McNamara, starring Devon Franklin, John Corbett, William H. Macy, is now in theaters. For showtimes and tickets in your area, check your local listings or visit soulonfiremovie.com. Thank you, Devon. See you soon.
Thanks, Raymond. Good to see you.
And that is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.